Welcome to Pause and Reflect, the podcast where compassion meets action, and where we dive deep into the stories of those who advocate for the voiceless, nurture our planet, and foster a more compassionate world. I'm your host, Alexander Taylor Clayton, here to explore the intersections of animal welfare, environmental sustainability, and the innovative solutions shaping our future. So sit back, stay curious, and join us as we reflect on the change we wish to see in the world. Let's embark on this journey together. Welcome back to Pause and Reflect, a podcast where we delve into the heart of animal ethics and environmental conservation. I'm your host, Alexander Taylor Clayton, and welcome. Thank you for joining me here again today. In today's episode, we're going to explore the concept of ethical conservation, a humane approach that prioritizes the well-being of individual animals while striving to protect our plant's ecosystems. In fact, we went over this concept just a little bit with Dr. Mark Beckoff in our inaugural episode for the season. Over the next 30 or so minutes, we'll discuss what ethical conservation means, its key principles, real-world applications, and so on. Now, non-invasive research techniques are methods used to study animals and ecosystems without causing harm or significant disturbance to the subjects. These techniques are especially important in ethical conservation efforts, as they prioritize the welfare of individual animals and the integrity of natural habitats. Some examples of non-invasive methods include camera traps, motion-activated cameras placed in strategic locations to capture images or videos of wildlife, very useful in monitoring animal populations, behaviors, movements, that sort of thing. Acoustic monitoring, which involves using audio recording devices to capture sound made by animals, such as bird calls, frog croaks, or even whale songs. They're very useful for surveying bird populations or monitoring marine mammals, such things like that. There's environmental DNA, collecting and analyzing DNA from environmental samples such as soil, water, and air. There's remote sensing, like GIS, Geographical Information Systems. This uses satellite or aerial imagery to gather information about ecosystems, landscapes. Really helps researchers monitor large areas and track changes over time. Very useful in today's world of scientific research. There's things like GPS and satellite telemetry, very similar. So when I refer to non-invasive methods or techniques, those are what I'm referring to for future reference. But let's move on to key principles of ethical conservation. What are some of those key principles that guide this movement, this ideology? I'm sure you can already guess what the first one is. It's going to be, first, do no harm. This principle emphasizes using non-invasive techniques wherever possible, whenever possible. For example, instead of capturing or tagging animals, researchers might use camera traps or non-invasive genetic sampling to gather data instead. A much better way, in my opinion. Number two, the intrinsic value of animals. Ethical conservation recognizes and respects the inherent worth of each animal, viewing them not just as a part of an ecosystem, but as beings with their own rights and values. Because remember, kiddies, we got to remember, we are animals too. We are a part of the animal kingdom. We are not separate. We are a part of the global complex that runs this beautiful marble in space. And if we're going to get things right and make a smoother, better, more holistic, more ethical framework of society, living, interaction with the world at large, the universe at large around us, we need to always remember that animals include us. It is not just us. It is every other species around. Because they have just as much right to exist within the universe as you do. It's important to remember that. And finally, number three, sustainable coexistence. Haha, leads right into that, doesn't it? This principle involves finding ways for humans and animals to live together in harmony. This might include creating wildlife corridors to connect fragmented habitats or implementing community-based conservation programs that benefit both people and wildlife. Eco-bridges are an amazing thing in this particular sphere or this direction of conservation. Oh, so wonderful. India has been doing amazing work, pioneering this for, I want to say, the last decade now. There's been talks about it here, even in the state of New Jersey, where I'm home, about forming eco-bridges, which is a wonderful way of reconnecting fragmented habitats, which is basically when humans come in with their society, with their developments, whatever human activity is going on. And what it is these patches of human work will then suddenly cut off and divulge, divide, there we go, divide up these different parcels of habitats that these creatures, other animals are living in, and making it so that they're cut off. If they're migrating from one area to another and then suddenly you build a highway across, they're suddenly trapped or they can't get back to where the previous territory was. And so what eco-bridges do, these are structures that we create that sort of blend, that work with nature to create corridors, pathways that connect these different areas of territory, of habitats with each other so that animals can continue to freely move without impeding us and us impeding them. And I love it. I think it's a wonderful marriage of ecological architecture and design. It's wonderful stuff. Please look into it. I'll put links in the description below for you to look at later. It's great stuff. And speaking of real world applications, this leads right into our case studies for this episode. So let's take a look at some real world examples of ethical conservation. For our first case study, we're going to look at habitat restoration in the Florida Everglades, which are efforts to restore natural water flow and habitat benefiting a wide range of species, including the endangered Florida panther and the American alligator, which are staples of American fauna. By focusing on restoring the ecosystem as a whole, this initiative aligns very well with ethical conservation principles by minimizing harm and promoting biodiversity. Now, to give a bit of background on this, the Florida Everglades, a vast and unique ecosystem, is often referred to as the River of Grass. It spans over 1.5 million acres, a very, very large swath of land, and is one of the most diverse habitats in North America, home to numerous plants and animal species, again, including Florida panther, American alligator, and various bird species as well. Over the past century, extensive drainage for agricultural, urban development, water management projects, etc., have significantly altered the natural landscape, leading to habitat loss, decreased water quality, and a decline in wildlife populations. And to go into this a little bit more in depth, with habitat loss alone, approximately 50% of the original Everglades have been lost due to human activity, as according to the Florida Department of Environmental Protection. With water quality, and this is a huge one for those who are a little bit more human-focused, because this affects everybody, including humans, pollutants from agricultural runoff, including phosphorus and nitrogen, have caused severe water quality issues, leading to harmful algae blooms and the decline of aquatic species. But this also affects local water drinking wells and reservoirs under the earth that affect human quality of existence. And when it comes to biodiversity decline, according to the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, the populations of wading birds have declined by about 90% since the 1930s, and species such as the Florida panther face critical habitat fragmentation and loss. A very dire situation over there. And when it comes to restoration efforts, this often involves a multifaceted approach, as most things in life do, combining scientific research, community involvement, and substantial financial investment. And this comes in the form of the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan, the CERP, which was authorized by Congress back in the year 2000. It's the largest environmental restoration project in U.S. history, with an estimated cost of over $10 billion. A lot of money. The primary goals are to restore the natural flow of water, improve water quality, and revive the ecosystem to support both wildlife and human needs, because as it currently stands, it is on the verge of complete collapse. Now, this is a very big and comprehensive, hence in the name, plan, and it involves more than 60 projects subcategoried underneath all this. But some of those projects include aquifer storage and recovery, such as storing excess water during wet periods and releasing it during dry periods to mimic natural water cycles. A very clever technique. Waterland rehydration, which reintroduces water to drained wetlands to restore the habitat for wading birds and other wildlife back to previous conditions as they were. And reservoirs and stormwater treatment areas, which capture and treat agricultural runoff to reduce nutrient pollution before it even enters the Everglades. So it's cutting it off at the pass. Really good and important project. And there are other additional initiatives that often work in tandem with this project and other projects underneath, I should say, such as water conservation areas, WCAs, which are managed to retain water and support wildlife. WCAs are crucial. They play a very critical role in maintaining the ecosystem's health. There's the Kissimmee River Restoration Project, which involves restoring the meandering path of the Kissimmee River, which had been channelized, to improve water quality and wildlife habitat. And there's also the Picayune Strand Restoration Project, which aims to restore a portion of the Everglades by removing canals and levees, rehydrating the wetlands, and enhancing wildlife corridors. And what's really nice about the Everglades restoration projects here are that they do emphasize non-invasive techniques, such as not using heavy machinery that could disrupt the habitats, and using more environmentally sensitive methods and employing them wherever possible. It is incredibly important in the projects that there is community involvement, engaging with local communities, including indigenous tribes, in planning and decision-making processes that ensure that these restoration efforts, they respect cultural values and traditional knowledge, as well as the intrinsic value of the animals that we are and the ecosystems we are trying to restore and save. And it is paramount of using sustainable practices that do not cause further harm, such as utilizing native plants for revegetation and implementing long-term monitoring to assess the effectiveness of these restoration activities. Now, what are the intended outcomes that we're looking for here? What are we hoping that these projects will achieve? Ultimately, what we want for these restoration projects are we're looking for improved water flow and quality, restoring efforts that lead to improvements in the water flow, mimicking more natural hydrological patterns, and enhancing water quality, benefiting both the wildlife and human communities around it. We're looking at habitat revival, which is wetland rehydration and other habitat restoration projects having led to the revival of these critical habitats for a wide range of species, including wading birds, fish, mammals. For example, the population of wood storks, a key indicator species in this particular habitat, has shown a significant increase since restoration efforts began, which is wonderful. We want to look for biodiversity recovery. Species that were once in decline, such as the Florida panther, have, thank goodness, shown signs of population recovery, highlighting the success of these ethical and comprehensive restoration efforts. And finally, community benefits. What are these restoration projects doing for the local community? So far, the restoration projects have provided economic benefits through job creation in restoration projects. It has increased tourism, and it has improved quality of life for local residents through enhanced natural spaces. All good things that we're looking for here. Now, unfortunately, there are some challenges that will come up with such long-term plans such as these. And one of the first ones, this is a huge one that we learn when you get a degree in anthropology, is that balancing competing interests. There are usually many invested agents or parties involved who have competing interests who want certain things done this way or other people want certain things done that way, and often trying to find a balance in the needs of agriculture, urban development, conservation, legal profit interests, because unfortunately those do exist no matter where you find them in a capitalist society. All of these require careful negotiation and compromise. So those are things that are always having to be on the lookout. And with long-term processes like these, we require ongoing funding, political will, and public support. Public support is the most crucial because public support feeds political will, which feeds ongoing funding. Please, if you like these projects, support them. I will be providing links if you want to look at some of these more in depth and to see what you can do to contribute to these later. They will be in the description. But to conclude for our first case study here, the restoration of the Florida Everglades serves as a model of ethical conservation in action. By prioritizing non-invasive techniques, engaging local communities, and focusing on not just sustainable practice, but eco-regenerative practices, this project demonstrates how large-scale environmental restoration can be achieved while respecting the intrinsic value of wildlife and their habitats. The Everglades Restoration Project is an excellent example to initiatives worldwide about the importance of a holistic, ethical approach to environmental stewardship. For our second case study, we're going to look at the translocation of black rhinos in Africa, which is to help combat poaching and habitat loss. conservationists have successfully relocated black rhinos to safer areas with better protection. This method not only helps increasing the population of black rhinos, but also ensures that minimal harm is caused during the process, adhering to ethical conservation standards. A bit of background on this. The black rhino, once abundant across sub-Saharan Africa, like many rhino species, have faced severe population declines due to poaching and habitat loss. In fact, the rhino was a species that I looked into for my degree. And if I'm remembering correctly, most of the rhino species that once existed, about at least, I want to say 70% of them, were wiped out to extinction within the last 100 years. By the early 1990s, black rhino numbers had plummeted by 96%, with fewer than 2,500 individuals remaining. Conservationists have employed various strategies to safeguard the species, including translocation, which involves moving rhinos from high-risk areas to safer, more suitable habitats. In an ideal world, we would not be encroaching on their habitat in the first place, and they could just, you know, hang out, live their best life where they would like. But that's not the case. Unfortunately, we have to contend with other humans, and that is, unfortunately, the next best solution at this time. When it comes to poaching, black rhinos have been heavily targeted for their horns, which are highly valued in illegal wildlife trade, as many of us are aware of, usually for reasons of culturally specific medicine, I will say. When it comes to things like habitat loss, there's human encroachment, agricultural expansion, which both have fragmented and reduced rhino habitats, making it very difficult for these populations to thrive. And finally, there's the genetic diversity aspect, which at this point, these are small, isolated populations of rhinos. And because of this, they are at risk of inbreeding, which can reduce genetic diversity and resilience against diseases. Bit of a no-brainer there on that one. So there's a lot of very serious issues here at play, not even just with this specific individual rhino species, but with all rhino species. All across the board are facing this severe existential threat to their entire existence. Now, there are two major initiatives going on right now with the translocation effort. There's the Black Rhino Range Expansion Project, BRREP, and the Kenya Wildlife Service, KWS. With the Black Rhino Range Expansion Project, they were launched in 2003 by the World Wildlife Fund and Azemvelo KZN Wildlife. They focus on creating new and secure populations of black rhinos by translocating them to protective areas all across South Africa. The goals of the initiative are, of course, increase black rhino numbers and genetic diversity by creating new breeding populations and reducing the risk of poaching. When it comes to the methodologies involved, rhinos are carefully selected based on genetic considerations, including health and age. They are then transported using specially designed crates and vehicles to minimize stress and injury. This is very critically important, especially for an animal of this size and stature. Once at a new site, they are monitored to ensure successful acclimatization and integration into the existing ecosystem. The Kenya Wildlife Service, KWS, is a very similar translocation initiative. They have conducted several successful translocations of black rhinos to bolster populations in key conservation areas like the Tsavo East National Park and Old Pujito Conservancy. And again, their primary goals here are to enhance population growth, improve genetic diversity, and reduce poaching risks. When it comes to their methodology, they use very rigorous planning and logistics to ensure that the safe and humane transport of these rhinos is in effect. Veterinary teams are involved, which usually involve tranquilizing safely, transporting safely, and monitoring safely the animals throughout the process. And once again, this is a case study that utilizes non-invasive techniques that minimize harm and stress, particularly during capture, transport, and release. The safe use of tranquilizers appropriately in designing these transport crates that ensure that these animals are comfortably and safely transported is of vital importance. Paramount is the community involvement involved here with national parks and local communities to help in benefit sharing from tourism, as well as involvement in monitoring and protecting these activities. Now, what are the outcomes that we are expecting, that we want to see here, that have occurred so far? So far, with population growth, these translocation efforts have led to significant population increases in several regions. For example, BRREP has successfully established 11 new populations of rhino, contributing to the overall growth of the black rhino population in South Africa. There's been enhanced genetic diversity by mixing individuals from different populations, and translocation helps to maintain and enhance the genetic diversity, which is crucial for the long-term resilience of the species. There has been reduced poaching. These rhinos that are now been translocated are in well-protected areas. They face lower poaching risks, which contributes to the overall species recovery. For example, the Old Pajita Conservancy in Kenya has become a safe haven for black rhinos, thanks to the robust anti-poaching measures instituted throughout Kenya. And finally, there's the community benefits. Local communities have fostered greater support for rhino conservation, and this in turn has provided economic benefits, again, through things like ecotourism, and have created jobs in wildlife management and protection. There are people out there who argue that a lot of initiatives or projects like this impede job creation of more, how I should say, industrial initiatives, but that's not true. Jobs are still being created. They're just in a different industry. That's all. Now, with an initiative and a project like this, there are, again, challenges that comes up with this. And those challenges include, some of those are logistical challenges. Translocating large animals like rhinos, they require extensive planning. It requires extensive resources, and it requires extensive coordination. Ensuring that these animals' health and safety during transport is paramount. There's the human-wildlife conflict. In some cases, newly introduced rhinos may come into conflict with human activities. This is a reality of the situation that needs to be handled with care. Effective conflict mitigation strategies are essential to ensure the success of these translocation efforts. And finally, there's long-term monitoring. Continuous monitoring is necessary to assess the success of translocated populations and in order to make adjustments as needed. And this requires sustained funding and commitment. Again, it comes back to public support, which goes back to political will, which goes back to ongoing funding. And to conclude with this particular case study, this underscores the importance of having a comprehensive, ethically driven approach in wildlife conservation. Because by prioritizing non-invasive techniques, engaging in local stakeholders, and ensuring sustainable practices, we can rebalance the needs of species with the well-being of individual animals and local communities to work in tandem with one another. This is an excellent case study of doing just that.
Before we dive deeper into today's topic, I want to take a moment to talk about the heart behind our podcast, RALDA, the Romanian League in Defense of Animals. RALDA is more than just an organization. It's a beacon of hope for thousands of animals in need. With a dual mission of rescuing distressed animals in Romania and preventing animal suffering through effective spay and neuter campaigns, RALDA has transformed the lives of animals and communities alike. Our efforts extend beyond rescue and rehabilitation. We're committed to creating sustainable solutions that address the root causes of animal homelessness and neglect. From building modern sanctuaries to provide a safe haven for animals, to education and outreach programs that foster a culture of care and respect, RALDA is on the front lines, making a tangible difference every single day. But this journey isn't one we walk alone. It's the support from people like you, our listeners, who share our passion for animal welfare that empowers RALDA to continue our vital work, whether it's by volunteering, spreading the word, or making a donation. Every action counts towards creating a better world for animals. To learn more about how you can be a part of this transformative mission, visit RALDA.org. If you would like to donate to RALDA and help save a life today, visit RALDA.org/donate. Together, we can make a difference, one animal at a time. Now, let's get back to our story.
And for our third case study on positive ethical conservation, we're going to look at community-led conservation in Nepal. This is community-led conservation efforts that showcase an exemplary model of ethical conservation by involving local communities in Nepal in the protection of wildlife, particularly the snow leopard. These projects ensure that conservation efforts are sustainable and beneficial for both humans and animals. Education and economic initiatives are provided to locals,
fostering a harmonious coexistence and minimizing human-wildlife conflict. So, a little bit of background on this one. Nepal, rich country in biodiversity and home to iconic species like the Bengal tiger and the great one-horned rhinoceros and the snow leopard, again, has faced significant challenges in wildlife conservation due to habitat loss, human-wildlife conflict, and poaching. Despite these challenges, Nepal has become a model for successful community-led conservation efforts, particularly through the establishment of community forests and conservation areas. We'll go into this a bit more. But first, so the issues at play here are habitat loss, human-wildlife conflict, and poaching and illegal trade. With habitat loss, there's deforestation and land conversion from agriculture that has led to significant habitat loss for many species. There's the increased interactions between humans and wildlife that has led to conflicts, especially with large predators and herbivores, causing crop and livestock losses. And there has been high demand for wildlife products, which has driven the poaching, threatening species such as the Bengal tiger and rhinoceros. Again, man, these poor rhinos. Leave them alone. Leave these rhinos alone. But to answer the call, Nepal has done incredible work with, I love this so much. I can't stress how much this is incredible. Community-led conservation in Nepal, which involves empowering local communities to manage and protect their natural resources, getting them hands-on, knee-deep, as it were. And these initiatives include community forests, buffer zone management, and conservation area management. Now, to start, community forests. I love this so much. Nepal's community forestry program, initiated in the late 1970s, so they've been doing this for a while, transfers forest management rights from the government to local communities. Amazing. By 2014, over 1.8 million hectares of forests were managed by more than 19,000 community forest user groups, CFUGs. Incredible, instead of the government. And they have, because of that, I am a big proponent of decentralization here, and this is a reason why. So, science has shown us that when you decentralize a system, you allow local regions and local areas who are better equipped, better trained, better intuitive to the local area because they are there, they are present, they can handle issues that arrive more nuanced. And because of that, it's more like the limbs of an octopus, and each of these like little brains are working in tandem with the larger brain, and it allows them to work more efficiently, get more done. There's less bureaucratic tape getting in the way. And this is a great thing. This is a wonderful thing. Because what these community forests do, their goals are to conserve biodiversity and improve forest cover and enhance the livelihood of local communities. And these CFUGs are responsible for managing forest resources, including the protection from illegal logging, sustainable harvesting of forest products, and reforestation activities. And this includes local communities implementing anti-poaching patrols, community awareness programs, etc. It is a wonderful, wonderful hands-on community initiative. It's great stuff. I hope the whole world, especially the U.S., takes a page out of Nepal with this great stuff here. With buffer zone management, now in the 1990s, Nepal introduced buffer zone management around protected areas, allowing local communities to use resources sustainably while reducing pressure on core conservation areas. This was a way of balancing the responsibilities going on here in the many wide arenas. The goals were to reduce human-wildlife conflict, enhance local livelihoods, and involve communities in conservation activities. But so the methodology behind this were these buffer zone committees would be established to manage resource use, implement conflict mitigation measures such as compensation schemes for crop damage, and support alternate livelihood projects like ecotourism and sustainable agriculture. In conservation area management, the Annapurna Conservation Area, ACA, established in 1986, is Nepal's largest protected area and a pioneering model for integrated conservation and development. Goals, again, conserve biodiversity, promote the sustainable development, and improve local livelihoods. That's managed by the National Trust for Nature Conservation. the NTNC. ACA involves local communities and decision-making processes, conservation activities, and benefit sharing from tourism revenues. Now that's a great way to get humans interested. Show them the money. Projects include habitat restoration, wildlife monitoring, and environmental education. This is incredible work. This is incredible stuff that Nepal is doing here with these community-led initiatives. This is exactly something that is deep in ethical conservation, and that is really getting people involved. Because when you have people involved, you can't really ignore what's going on when you're looking at it. When you yourself have a hand involved, then you have a stake in what's going on. You're invested. And that is important. That is so important for getting large swaths of humans behind these very important initiatives, these very important ethical paradigms here. You got to get them invested. And this is a great way of doing that and showing investment in local community. Wonderful stuff. Wonderful stuff. We see local empowerment. We see through the transferring of management rights to local communities, conservation efforts respect and leverage traditional knowledge and practices. This empowers communities to take ownership of conservation activities and benefit directly from sustainable resource use. There's sustainable livelihoods. Conservation initiatives are designed to improve the economic well-being of local communities through sustainable tourism, agriculture, and forest product harvesting, reducing the incentive for illegal activities. And with conflict mitigation, implementing measures to reduce human-wildlife conflict, such as compensation schemes, predator-proof enclosures, and alternate livelihood projects, which helps balance conservation goals with community needs. So what are our outcomes here? We have forest cover improvement. Community forestry has led to significant improvements in forest cover and quality. Studies show increased forest density and biodiversity in community-managed forests compared to state-managed forests. Why? Well, because local communities are going to be more invested in this project actually working than the state is. There's too much that the state has to worry about. Again, decentralized. Wildlife population recovery. Effective management in buffer zones and conservation areas has contributed to the recovery of key species like the Bengal tiger and greater one-horned rhinoceros. The Nepal's tiger population has increased by 19% from 2010 to 2018, according to the World Wildlife Fund. That's amazing. That's wonderful. That you love to hear it. There has been economic benefits. Community-led conservation has provided substantial economic benefits to local communities through ecotourism and sustainable resource use. The ACA tourism revenues have funded local infrastructure, health, and education projects, enhancing overall community welfare. And finally, enhanced community engagement. Local communities are actively involved in conservation activities, leading to increased environmental awareness and stewardship. Beautiful. Beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. This engagement is critical for the long-term sustainability of conservation efforts. Well done, Nepal. And now, of course, what are the challenges involved here? Well, you got to balance conservation and development, ensuring that conservation efforts do not negatively impact local livelihoods. This requires very careful planning and continuous community involvement. Shouldn't be a problem, though. Based on everything we're seeing here. Sustainable funding. Long-term success depends on securing sustainable funding sources for conservation activities, including tourism revenues and external grants. Again, this goes back to public support, political will, ongoing funding. Remember that. Remember that. Get it in your heads. And then there's adaptive management. Continuous monitoring and adaptive management are absolutely necessary to address emerging challenges and ensure the effectiveness of conservation strategies. New things will arise. New issues will occur. Being able to adapt as things go on is, of course, vital. And that's true of anything in life. So what can we conclude here from this case study? Nepal's community-led conservation initiatives demonstrate a successful model for integrating biodiversity conservation with sustainable development. By prioritizing local empowerment, sustainable livelihoods, and conflict mitigation, these efforts have significantly contributed to the conservation of critical species and habitats. This case study underscores the importance of inclusive, ethical approaches in achieving long-term conservation success. So,
After those three case studies, what are our ethical considerations when it comes to conservation practices? It's balancing ethics and effectiveness in conservation can be challenging. For example, managing invasive species often involves difficult decisions. Ethical conservationists strive to find humane methods such as relocation or sterilization rather than lethal control. Another challenge is wildlife relocation, which can be stressful for animals. By prioritizing their welfare and well-being and ensuring they are moved to suitable habitats, we can mitigate negative impacts. It's crucial to constantly evaluate and refine these approaches, though, to ensure that they align with ethical standards. As we learn more, as our knowledge and understanding of these other cultures and societies and other species and their well-being and their health, as we learn more, it is important that we continually reevaluate and refine. Now, we've looked at three positive case studies for ethical conservation. I want to show you an example of a negative case study, and this is extremely relevant to what's going on right now, because this is going to be a case study on the barred owls versus spotted owls. Many of you have probably heard in the news about this going on, about how the United States has decided effectively that in order to save one species of owl, they're going to kill off another species of owl in this area in order to maintain equilibrium in the ecosystem. We're going to get into that. So what this is the United States Fish and Wildlife Service has made the decision to cull barred owls to protect the endangered spotted owl. This method was chosen due to the competitive pressure barred owls exert on the spotted owl's habitat, threatening their survival. However, naturally, this approach has sparked considerable debate with critics, of which I include myself, and I hope, dear listeners, you as well. Critics arguing that, one, it causes unnecessary harm to barred owls. Two, it may not even address the root causes of habitat loss and environmental degradation. And three, it raises ethical questions about whether it's justifiable to harm one species to save another. In fact, again, referring to our previous episode, our first episode with Dr. Mark Beckoff, an advocate for ethical conservation, he emphasized that such practices often fail to align with the core values of minimizing harm and maintaining ecological balance. Now, to get into the background of this, the northern spotted owl, a species native to the old-growth forest of the Pacific Northwest, has been declining due to habitat loss from logging and other human activities. Listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act since 1990, 2 years before I was even born, efforts to protect the spotted owl have included habitat preservation and restrictions on logging. However, a new threat emerged in the form of the barred owl, an aggressive species that expanded its range from the eastern United States into the spotted owl's territory. The issue: the arrival of the barred owl has exacerbated the decline of the spotted owl through direct competition for food and nesting sites, as well as hybridization. Oh no. Barred owls are more adaptable and have a broader diet, which gives them a competitive edge over the more specialized spotted owls. So, with this issue, what are the conservation efforts involved here? Well, naturally, the United States figured, hey, in order to address the decline of the spotted owl, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the USFWS, proposed a controversial strategy: the lethal removal of barred owls. This approach involves killing barred owls to reduce competition and give the spotted owl a better chance of recovery. Yo, don't worry, we'll call this one so you can have a better chance, champ. That's the vibe I get from that. The ethical implications of this strategy has sparked significant debate among conservationists, ethicists, and the public, and rightfully so, frankly. We have some key issues here: invasive species management, animal welfare and well-being, effectiveness, and ecological balance. First off, with the invasive species management, Barred owls are considered invasive in the Pacific Northwest, having expanded their range due to changes in the landscape and climate. Managing invasive species often involve difficult decisions, including lethal control to protect native species and ecosystems. Unfortunately, lethal control is a standard practice. When it comes to animal well-being here, ethical conservation emphasizes minimizing harm to all animals involved. The lethal removal of barred owls raises significant concerns about the morality here of killing one species to save another. Then there's the effectiveness. Studies indicate that removing barred owls can lead to increased survival and reproduction of spotted owls. Sure, that makes sense to a degree. But, however, the long-term sustainability of this approach is questioned, as continued removal may be necessary to maintain benefits. This isn't addressing the actual core root issue here, because going into the fourth one, ecological balance, ecosystems are complex, and removing one species can have unforeseen consequences. The ecological role of barred owls in their new habitat has to be considered here. And also, it's still not addressing the root cause that caused all this in the first place, which is invasive human activity on these habitats and territories, forcing the barred owl to move into the spotted owl's territory. We are causing these species of owl to fight and conflict with each other for territory because their territories are respectively ever increasingly dwindling because of human activity. Adoy. If we want to practice ethical conservation, we have to consider the ethics involved here. We have to do first, do no harm. Ethical conservation seeks to avoid harm wherever possible. Non-lethal methods such as habitat restoration and creating barriers to prevent barred owl expansion should be prioritized here. The intrinsic value of animals, both barred and spotted owls, have intrinsic value. Ethical approaches must weigh the rights and well-being of individual animals against the need to preserve species and ecosystems. But you want to look at it as the minority being overwhelmed by majority here. Sustainable coexistence, finding ways for both species to coexist, such as enhancing habitat for spotted owls or creating refugees free from barred owls, aligns with ethical conservation principles. So we have the current strategy employed by the USFWS, which should be being enacted very soon, unfortunately, that of lethal control, which at best is a short-term measure to reduce barred owl populations in critical areas for spotted owl recovery, versus the proposed strategy by critics and myself as well of that of habitat restoration, enhancing and expanding old-growth forest habitats to support larger populations of spotted owls and reduce competition between barred owls and the spotted owls in the first place. It's a long-term strategy versus a short-term solution that aligns with ethical principles by improving conditions for both species. Listener, it is important that you voice your complaints about this. If I hope you disagree with the lethal control method, and speak your voice, speak your mind, share this on social media. Reach out to your local representatives involved in this. I will be placing, again, links involved in everything that we've talked about in this episode in the description so you can check them out yourself. Please get involved. Speak out. Say something. Your voice matters. Every voice matters, especially those who aren't able to have a voice in a human referendum, in this case, the barred owls. So what do we conclude here with this case study? While the goal of saving the spotted owl is clear, the methods used to achieve this goal must be carefully considered to ensure that they align with ethical conservation principles, and as they currently stand, they absolutely do not. Balancing the needs for both species, minimizing harm, striving for sustainable coexistence are crucial components of any ethical approach to conservation, or really to just existence. So where does that leave us with the future of ethical conservation? Well, the future of conservation is bright with the rise of ethical practices. Emerging technologies such as drone monitoring and genetic analysis offer new ways to study and protect wildlife without causing harm. Additionally, increased awareness and education are fostering a culture of compassion and respect for all living beings. As more people and organizations adopt ethical conservation methods, we can look forward to a world where humans and animals thrive together in harmony. With every generation that comes after, millennial, Gen Z, now Alpha, ever increasingly is there a societal shift by these generations in a sense of societal value towards things like ethical conservation. We have these emerging trends and technologies such as genetic monitoring, remote sensing in drones, acoustic monitoring, and so on. Fantastic advances in non-invasive research techniques. We have community-based conservation, empowering local communities, incorporating indigenous knowledge. We have policy and legislation. Ethical guidelines and standards are constantly being developed and being implemented. New ethical guidelines for conservation practices, helping to standardize humane approaches across different regions and projects. Legislative support. People advocating for laws and policies that protect both species and individual animals, creating a legal framework that supports ethical conservation. There is increased public awareness and engagement. As ethical conservation becomes more prominent, public awareness and support for humane practices are growing. Educational campaigns and media coverage, both, they help inform and engage the public. This fosters a culture of compassion and respect for all living beings. There's global collaboration, international cooperation and knowledge sharing, enhancing ethical conservation efforts worldwide. Collaborative projects and networks facilitating the exchange of best practices, technologies, and resources, leading to more effective and humane conservation strategies. When it comes to things like the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, SDGs, integrating ethical conservation can help align global conservation efforts with broader objectives in sustainability, eco-regeneration, social equity, animal rights, and environmental justice. This holistic approach can ensure that conservation benefits both wildlife and human communities. This would begin to truly reflect a universal human value of reverence and respect and oneness with nature. But better still, I think, it would be a testament to humanity's ever-amazing ability to grow. Ethical conservation practices can enhance the resilience and adaptability of ecosystems in the face of climate change and other environmental challenges. By prioritizing the well-being of individuals and promoting biodiversity, these practices can support healthier and more robust ecosystems. So, again, I say the future of ethical conservation is bright, with promising trends and technologies paving the way for more humane and effective environmental stewardship. By embracing non-invasive research methods, empowering local communities, and advocating for ethical policies, we can create a world where humans and wildlife coexist harmoniously. As we move forward, it is essential to maintain a commitment to compassion, respect, and sustainability in all conservation efforts, and ideally eco-regenerativeness too. To support ethical conservation, consider volunteering with organizations that practice humane methods, or donating to support their work, or even advocating for policies that prioritize animal well-being. Every action counts towards making a more compassionate world. Again, I encourage you to check out the resources and links in both the description and on the page for the website for this particular episode. Please get involved, learn more, educate yourself, get out there, make a difference. Your voice matters, and you have the power to do amazing things. I believe in you. I know you can do it. I love you. Thank you for joining us today on this journey into ethical conservation. Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review Pause and Reflect on wherever you get your podcast. Please, every bit helps. Man, those algorithms are tough, and seriously, every little bit really does help. I thank you so much for it. Visit our website, follow us on social media for more updates and content. Until next time, let's continue to make a difference, one compassionate step at a time. I'm Alexander Taylor Clayton, and I'm here to encourage you to stop and think about the world around you. Take care.